for this morning is United States against Heron. Mr. Dressel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Christopher Dressel. I'm here as court-appointed counsel for the appellant Rohan G. Heron. A jury of the United States District Court for the Southern District of Illinois convicted Mr. Heron of possession with intent to distribute illegal narcotics, and he was sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. His conviction was marred by two errors, each of which independently requires reversal. However, in the limited time afforded to me this morning, I'd like to focus on just one issue, and that is that the government exercised a peremptory strike against a member of the Meniere juror over what the government refers to as her, quote, heightened religiosity. Under the rationale, if not the precise holding, of the Supreme Court's decision in Bassam versus Kentucky and JEB versus Alabama, this is unconstitutional.
So, Mr. Dressel, I've looked actually numerous times at this little exchange between the prosecutor and defense counsel, and the court interjects here and there, and I cannot find an objection based on this theory of yours, based on the idea that Batson also prohibits the exercise of peremptory challenges on some sort of religious basis. And I'm being deliberately a little bit vague there, because some courts have focused on actually one's formal religious affiliation, some have focused on viewpoint, whatever. And not only do I not find that objection, but in this case, it actually isn't even juror number 9. It's some concern about her mother and her daughter, right?
That's right. So this seems like two questions to me. I'll try and address them in order. As to the first point, I agree that defense counsel's articulation of his concern regarding the religious reason given for striking Meniere juror number 9 was unartful and perhaps a bit unclear. But if you look at the specific words that he uses, it's clear that he has a concern and an issue with the religious basis for that challenge. The government's theory is that he was simply pressing his race-based Bassam challenge.
But well, when you look at the discussion as a whole, it sure looks like that, because they're talking about how many African-Americans there are on the panel, who's still there, and defense counsel does say, and I know this is what you're relying on, just means they believe in God and they want to help people. And then he concludes this little passage by saying there's absolutely nothing here with regard to this lady that would justify her removal from this jury panel. But how he ties that in with something as powerful as a Batson objection, saying despite the fact that you have peremptories, this is not a reason you can use them, that's where I'm having trouble.
The point I'm trying to make is that he doesn't have to make a powerful argument in order to preserve it.
But he has to alert the court to the fact that this is where he's going.
And I think he did when he pointed out that the connection between this juror's supposed religious preferences and her ability to serve on the jury is tenuous, and I think the word he uses is, quote, absolutely would not justify her removal from the panel. And what the Supreme Court said in Ford versus Georgia is that when, in terms of preserving a Batson argument for appeal, the question is whether the comments that the defense counsel made at trial could be reasonably understood and reasonably intended to have raised an argument under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, the alternative.
And if it's a core Batson argument, race or gender, then what the court is saying in Ford is it can be inartfully expressed, and yet the judge is supposed to keep an ear out for it. But an extension of this sort of Batson seems to me you have to say the reason they want her off the jury is because of her religion. We think that's impermissible under Batson. Please don't allow this strike, something like that.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because Ford was authored at a time when there really was no core Batson rule. Ford was authored sort of during the change in law between the Swain rule and the Batson rule, and what happened in Ford was that the defendant didn't articulate an equal protection clause based objection because he didn't think one was viable under the previous rule, and the court said that because his argument could be reasonably understood and reasonably intended to have made an equal protection clause argument, even though he actually didn't, the issue was preserved for appeal. Yeah. And, in fact, the same fact scenario occurred in Bastin itself. The defendant realized that under Swain v. Moore, he had no argument under the burden of proof that case imposed, and so he made a Sixth Amendment argument and an argument based on the Kentucky Constitution. Those arguments failed, but the Supreme Court didn't care. It addressed the argument as though it was an equal protection argument, even though the defendant never actually made an equal protection argument. Now, here in this case, the government argues that he's really pressing a race-based objection, but, Your Honor, I understand it's concerned about where you find language in the transcript regarding my theory. But I would point out there's absolutely no language in this transcript that supports the government's theory that this is a race-based objection.
Well, sometimes religious objections have been veiled race-based objections. There are particular church denominations that are well known to be very predominantly African-American denominations, and if somebody says, I'm striking her because she's from the AME church, somebody might say, hey, that's really just a race-based strike and it's impermissible. So they get blended.
I understand. That's why it's perplexing that if he was trying to make that argument, he didn't say anything of the sort. He didn't make the only argument that would help him to preserve and to continue to press his race-based challenge. And there is no...
Well, he actually came pretty close, right? Because he makes a crystal clear race-based Batson challenge, right?
Correct.
And then the government responds, and the defense counsel responds, in essence, don't believe this. He's making a pretext argument without using that word.
I respectfully disagree with that. He never says pretext. He never says this is insincere or disingenuous or that you shouldn't believe it. Rather, he speaks to the quality of the reason itself. He says... Mm-hmm. There's no link between her religious preferences and ability to serve on the jury, and it absolutely would not justify her
removal. Mr. Dressel, let me put it to you this way. If I'm the district judge presiding over this exchange, how am I supposed to figure out that the defense counsel is asking me to resolve a difficult and weighty issue of constitutional law that the Supreme Court has deliberately left open up to date?
The reason the district court would address that issue is because the defense counsel is not continuing to press his race-based challenge, and he's specifically asking why is it appropriate for the government to invoke this juror's or this juror's mother's religious preferences as a reason to exclude her from the jury. And the defense counsel concludes that colloquy by saying that it absolutely would not justify her removal.
I think your answer to Judge Hamilton's question has to be, that religion is a sort of third rail. The judge hears the word religion, and in your view, he's supposed to perk up, he is supposed to perk up and say, wait a minute, are we engaged in religious discrimination all of a sudden?
I agree, and I think that defense counsel said enough that he ought to have perked up, and he didn't, and the colloquy just died. But I don't think the ultimate reaction to the district judge by the district court is what's important. What's important is what defense counsel said, and I think I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Sure. Mr. Liggins. A minute. Yes, it's still morning.
Just barely. I was, pardon me, I was not the attorney below, but I will endeavor just to make a couple of quick points and answer whatever questions your honors might have for me. I guess the first concern that is one that I share with the court is that there wasn't anything that was said before the district court that could reasonably put the court on notice that a religious-based objection was being made here. In fact, I don't, my reading of the record, and I have actually reached the point in my career and maybe my life where finality is of these things is the overriding concern for me. I don't see anything where I would have felt compelled, had I been the attorney, to stand up as an officer of the court with an interest in finality and say, hold on a second, judge, I think there's an issue that was raised here that that we've missed.
But the defense counsel does say there's absolutely nothing here that would justify her removal after the discussion of belief in God. And there, you know, our court has had some cases, the Stafford case, other circuits have had cases, and people are exploring this, the Supreme Court's denial of cert being a good example of that. And I'm very uncomfortable myself with the idea of saying that you could use a peremptory challenge to delete all the Muslims from a panel, for example. Would you really want to stand up and say, I'm exercising this challenge because he's Muslim?
Your Honor, the I guess that is kind of, it goes into a couple of issues. I don't believe you could stand up. The state of the law is I don't believe you could base a peremptory, or at least there is a division in the circuits about whether or not you can base a peremptory on religious affiliation as opposed
right.
to religious
Right, so
reason.
I'm familiar with that. And then the next question is there actually a meaningful difference between religious affiliation in the sense of, you know, one's identification with a particular known religion and what courts are calling religiosity, whatever that is supposed to mean, you know, that this is just a person who's a deeply spiritual person who happens to take guidance from a school of thought. You know, can you tell the difference?
I can tell the difference on the basis that the way I have seen them analyzed in the cases that I've looked at is that the adherence to religious principles in general can be justified to the extent if it can be articulated that it makes someone more likely to convict or more likely to acquit.
Right, and that's precisely the follow-up that does not happen with juror number 9. We have no question, you know, are you capable of deciding this based on the evidence in front of you and the instructions as given to you by the judge? We don't know what juror 9 would have said about that. We don't know whether she has any views. For all you know, she's a Puritan, and she's going to be very pro-prosecution, you know, send them all to prison, you know. So that's... You're right that that's what has focused in. If somebody says, you know, look, I just could never send somebody to prison for a victimless crime, that's not the person you want on your sale of marijuana case. That's not the person you want on whatever else people think victimless crimes are. So it seems to me that's a pretty easy one. But usually there's that follow-up, you know, despite this characteristic of yours, are you able to render a fair decision?
And I believe that gets us back to the failure, in my view, to raise a concrete religious-based Batson challenge, and that is the problem. I read the colloquy that occurred here as Judge Hamilton did. This is an inquiry into, and this is a complaint by the defense attorney that this is just being offered as a pretext, not that the ground itself of religiosity is verboten.
Derivative religiosity from family members.
Yes. Hearsay religiosity.
The ADA works with associated with a person with a disability,
that.
Right?
Yeah.
I believe that would have happened if the claim would have been more. It would have had to have been because of the remedy in a Batson before this court. I mean, if someone raises a legitimate Batson claim, the court has to address it, because if this court says he or she got it wrong, it's coming back.
Right.
Mr. Liggins, can I ask you about a different question? The co-conspirator hearsay issue that was in the briefs.
Yes.
And I'm just curious, the court gave a limiting instruction saying that the co-conspirator's statement to the officer was not, it was being admitted as a statement of a former co-conspirator and not necessarily for the truth of the matter asserted in the statement.
I noticed that also, Your Honor, and I'm
perplexed.
I'm befuddled. Obviously, if it comes in as a co-conspirator statement, it's admissible for its truth under 801 D. And I'm sorry, Judge.
I'm also, frankly, a little, I don't think I've ever seen a district judge explain to the jury, this is coming in because he's a former co-conspirator, which seems to imply a finding highly relevant to the jury's ultimate verdict.
Yes.
As opposed to just saying it's coming in.
It's coming in, yes, but you shouldn't consider it for its truth. The I believe that was the limiting instruction was requested by the defense, I believe.
It was. I'm just wondering why it was given. So,
I believe, if I could just follow up for 1 second, I believe that bears into the harmless error analysis because it was admissible for its truth. It could have been argued for its truth, and it was restricted even from that. So I think that bears also on the harmless error analysis.
Yeah.
And if there are no further questions, I will yield the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Dressel?
To sort of recapitulate the issue of whether the Batson challenge was preserved, I think there it boils down to essentially one question. What is the most plausible interpretation of what the defense counsel said? Was he trying to press his race-based Batson challenge, or was he objecting to the use of religion? I think you can answer that by observing that there was absolutely nothing in that transcript that invoked pretext, insincerity, disingenuousness, or any other language that he would have needed to use in order to suggest that he did not buy the explanation and was continuing to press the Batson challenge. So I think in that context, the argument was preserved.
If it was preserved,
yes.
What could you tell me what rule you want us to apply?
Mm-hmm. The rule that
a very difficult area.
Mm-hmm. I agree. The rule that I want the court to apply is that the use of religion, to the extent that it implicates it's a suspect distinction under the Equal Protection Clause, is not a legitimate basis for a peremptory challenge. And so,
any dimension of religion. Affiliation, religiosity, general spirituality, association, activities, anything.
I think as the JEB case says, it has to be used as a proxy and not direct evidence for bias. So if a juror came into court, as this court suggests in Stafford, and indicated that his or her religious beliefs would prevent her from considering the evidence according to the law or following the judge's instructions, that would be direct evidence of bias not being used as a proxy, and therefore it would be entirely permissible to strike that juror, even though those
for cause. Were
but that's
religious.
A cause strike,
yeah.
Of course. It's not a peremptory.
You could strike that juror for cause and also as a peremptory challenge if the juror wasn't struck for cause.
If for some reason, yes. I can't be fair, but strike for cause is denied.
So that's my position, unless
okay.
There's anything further.
All right. Thank you very much. And you were appointed. And so we thank you very much for your assistance.